no crying in baseball!
You're 5 feet nothing, 100 and nothing, and you got hardly a speck of athletic ability. And you hung in with the best college football team in the land for 2 years.
I said, fuck you, Joe. I do it myself.
In here, there were two guys killing each other. But I guess that's better than 20 million. But what I'm trying to say is that if I can change, then you can change. Everybody can change.
Welcome to Montucky Skies. I'm Biggs.
And I'm George Miller.
George Miller.
Well, you may know me best as the director of Babe, Pig in the City, or Happy Feet, but other people know me from my quadrilogy of science fantasy films.
Oh, Mad Max,
The Road Warrior, Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, and Mad Max Fury Road.
So you seem pretty excited about Mad Max.
So excited.
Okay, we got an agenda. I'm just going to set it out right out of the gate. So I have Weird Tangent, which can wait a little bit. Mad Max to talk about. We got to talk about the Mad Men finale, right?
About Mad Men, yes.
Yeah, Brandon's not here, so this is the perfect time. Like, he just told us to fuck off and left. No, not really. He's going camping.
So let's go back down the agenda. We've got Weird Tangent, Mad Max, Mad Men. I owe an apology to Josh Trank.
I got to find out what the news is.
And I've got a little tag for the end of the episode. But other than that, I'm cleared out after that.
Yeah. So we got an agenda here.
Perfect.
Tonight, folks.
It's almost as if we plan.
Yeah. And I didn't.
I've literally never planned
other
once
than
in
the
my
Mad
life.
Max thing. We did plan out that.
Yes.
Or Mad Max. No, Mad Men. Yeah. I'm getting my mads.
It's a mad world.
Mixed up. Well, I'm going to say right out of the gate, me and Zach, there might be a little, like, Zach's had a rough day. I've had some wine. It's going to get a little salty,
yeah.
Especially when I go to my weird place. So, Shannon Beardsley, you turn this off right now.
Shannon, I want you to listen very carefully to what I'm about to say. This is going to go to a dark place.
Yeah.
Your dad is not here to rein us in today.
And I don't want to say the things that your dad should maybe teach you, but probably not.
I don't want you testifying in court against me.
Right.
So
Shannon, you need to turn this off right now.
This would be
an
awesome
place to stop. You can tune back
in
next week.
Wait till you turn 18, then you can tune into this episode.
Any other 13-year-olds, you've been warned.
That's right.
You might learn things that you don't want to learn.
Shannon is the proxy for the rest of you.
That's right. Well, since we talked about Mad Max right out of the gate, you should just start on this.
Mad fucking Max. Okay, so I saw Mad Max Fury Road.
No.
I know. Surprising, right? This movie is better than the others in the franchise, and it's not particularly close. As a matter of fact, this is a masterpiece. A legitimate masterpiece. And I'll go one step further. This is the best action movie of this century.
Wow, that's high praise.
High praise, and I do not shy away. In fact, I will go so far as to say that when I was watching this the second time, I thought to myself, right around the moment when Nicholas Holt screams, "Oh, what a lovely day," I thought to myself, you know, not only do I love this movie, I'm mad at other movies for not being this movie. This movie is so great, it made me like other movies less.
And I gotta say, how great it must be to be a young nerd, because
yeah.
I remember when I was a young nerd and I saw the first Lord of the Rings movie in the theater 3 times. I did. I'm not even like making it up.
There's no girlfriend to say, Zach, you don't have to see the mutants again. You know what's gonna happen already. There's no one to tell me no.
And they will always tell you that too.
And since that person,
even when it's like a movie that doesn't have mutants,
that's
and it's
right.
really obnoxious.
And I'm so glad I got to see this, because the Doof Warrior. Oh, yeah. There's a character named the Doof Warrior. And the Doof Warrior
is
my spirit animal. No, Doof. I learned this from reading some George Miller interviews. The Doof Warrior's name comes from Australian slang for club music and metal music. Doof is sort of the onomatopoeia for the sound the drums and bass make. So it's basically like when you hear
doof,
electronic.
Doof, 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 doof.
Yeah, exactly. The Doof Warrior is a blind mutant with bleached white skin and no lips. Lips have been removed. He is suspended on like a metal, and I say metal, not like the material, but metal like, fuck yeah, metal. A really metal hammock that is suspended between two preposterously tall towers of amplifiers that are on board of a truck that is also carrying about a bunch of drummers. And as this truck is rolling, you see the Doof Warrior swinging back and forth in his hammock, playing an electric guitar with two necks, one guitar, one bass guitar, playing war music for the groups. Oh yeah, and by the way, the guitar shoots fire.
Yeah, I've heard about the guitar shooting fire.
This movie is what I see in my head when I listen to Black Flag. Like, this this is a two-hour visual thesis statement on punk rock. It's possibly the greatest things my eyes have beheld. Charlize Theron, badass.
I've heard weird things about, like, this movie is actually, like, a very pro-feminist movie.
Super pro-feminist in an awesome way.
Okay.
In a really great way.
What makes it so pro-feminist?
Okay, so the first thing is that Mad Max, despite being the titular character, the real protagonist of the film is Charlize Theron's Imperator Furiosa. But her mission is led by stealing the five wives, who are the five wives of a Morton Joe, played by Hugh Keyes Byrne, who also played Toe Cutter in the first Mad Max. And he's the sort of mutated fucking monster deity pharaoh thing. And he has,
you know, another one of those, like Stargate, only,
you know, like every way more movie masculine. Has. And he has these five wives, which are these young, beautiful, relatively untouched by radiation women who essentially act as his breed mares. And, they try to escape to go to the green place where Furiosa was raised. And so she agrees to sneak them out when they go on their run to Gas Town. And so as they're driving, she turns off and she's going to steal them away and rescue them. So it also becomes about these five women and the way they view the world around them. And it sort of revolves around this question, who killed the world? And the movie throws out a bunch of different answers at you for that question. In the way that this movie does, where there is zero exposition. There is no exposition in this movie. It's either you figure out what's going on or fuck you.
And I mean, it's kind of already set in the world, right? Like a part totally. Four, you shouldn't be expected to be resetting up what...
No, although this doesn't rely too much on Mad Max continuity.
I mean, what is there to go off of continuity, though? I mean,
basically, like, just saying what happened to Max at that point.
But why?
And it
why
I agree.
Would you?
Why? And they don't, because it plays better as though he's this mythological figure. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the way this movie plays, is almost like a mythology or a morality tale. So it's very feminist in that way. Where it becomes super feminist is about 2/3 of the way through the movie, you meet the Vuvalini. And the Vuvalini are the natives of the Greenland, where Charlize Theron's Imperator Furiosa was raised. And these are these old weathered women. They've got like the cracked skin and like the leather look on their face. You can tell they've been around a while. And like most people, when grannies show up in an action movie, my first instinct was, oh no, this is going to suck. And then the grannies rule. They set dope traps. They can snipe like a motherfucker.
Oh, when you say dope traps, do they have like a bag of weed under like like a slip knot to like hang upside down by a tree? Or
actually, they're traps.
Or is that just awesome traps?
Just awesome traps.
Okay.
They're crazy snipers. They tool around on motorbikes. Like, they're so hardcore, but they also have this super maternal, caring instinct. And you can really see it. There's the scene where Charlize Theron goes out to call the Vuvalini, and they come out and talk to her, and she introduces the five wives as well as Mad Max and the war boy Nux. And immediately the Vuvalini don't trust these people they don't know. But as they start talking them, you see this motherly quality come out as they start interacting with the five wives and caring for them. And this movie is about who killed the world, what specifically killed the world, and what can be done to, if not bring it back, at least stabilize it. And a lot of that comes through women and giving them their freedom and giving them their humanity back. But it's not feminist in a way where it's like, women fuck yeah, men fuck you. It's more like, it's feminist in a way where it says, listen, women are powerful, we've been underrating them and disrespecting them. women are necessary and we understand that, but we've been treating them like objects instead of people. But also that women aren't flawless, invincible creatures like this. We have to be looking out for each other. And you see this in the way that Charlize Theron's Furiosa, she saves Mad Max multiple times and he saves her. And neither of them would have survived the journey and the events of the film without one another. And it's, and that's very much reflected throughout the plot. You also see it in the arc of Nux, the war boy, who probably has the greatest character arc in the film. And when I say greatest, what I mean by that is he is the most different from point A to point B. And you see him, he starts as this sickly kid who wants to fight to prove himself. Then you see him as this crazed warrior trying to impress his god and his leader. Then you see him as someone scared because he can't tell whether he should betray his fellow warriors or protect the people he's with now. Then you see him start to understand life. Then you see him start to understand love and relationship as one of the five wives takes pity on him and cares for him. Then you see him understand brotherhood as he starts to protect Mad Max, even though he has no reason to. And there's so many metaphors like this layered in without a word being spoken to pick it up. Like, you really have to be paying attention. And that's where this movie really succeeds, is it can work as just eye candy. It's one of the most gorgeous films I've ever seen in my life. But it also works on these deep moral levels, and not just from the feminist aspect, but it has opinions about capitalism. It has opinion about reliance on fossil fuels. It has opinions about reliance on war and how men are called to war even when they don't want to be, to the point that Mad Max early on in the film has a literal blood tie to war boys. Like, this is a film that I could probably write a thesis statement on if I were so inclined. There is so much going on. And I haven't even talked about the fucking... This movie is basically one long chase scene with the occasional 2 to 3 minute break to catch your breath. And the opening car chase, the very first one when Imperator Furiosa hits the road, is one of the greatest car chases I've ever seen on film. And it's by far the worst car chase in the movie. It's that level of good. And it culminates in this amazing battle at the end where some of the war boys are riding on these cars. And these cars, they're little small buggies, almost like Mini Coopers with no tops. And they have these big poles coming out of them. And the bottom of the pole has a counterweight that swings back and forth. And the top of the pole has a place for the war boys to stand as they swing around. And basically what they do is they swing down on these poles, snatch people out of the other cars or steal weapons from the other cars and launch back into the air where they can't be touched. Like, the things that are happening in this movie are incredible visually. It's about 80% practical effects. Most of the CGI is either for backgrounds or shots of like bodies being sucked out of a car into the distance. But in terms of like the things exploding or the cars crashing, it's or the jumping, it's more for
stuff that like they just can't
exactly
do practically.
Anything. See, they that's could what do I like. Practically
that's what I
did.
Like when they do CGI.
I'm shocked no one died making this movie. I'm genuinely shocked no one died. And you hear reports from the set, and Tom Hardy was like, I almost got beheaded 3 different times on this movie. It's insane. And it's so awesome to the point that Mad Max is almost non-existent in the first chase scene. He's chained to the front of a car for almost the entire chase scene. He has an action scene at the beginning, and he doesn't really come into play until the start of the second act when you meet the five wives. This film, it's so dense. The world building is incredible. Every shot tells you more about the world without spelling it out for you like you're an idiot. There's little details of mythology, like the war boys chroming their grills as they go into a kamikaze situation, which basically consists of them huffing chrome spray paint and leaving a silver look across their mouths because they worship the god of the V8. So it's both getting high to pump them up and like get their adrenaline going, but also so that they look beautiful for their god when they reach Valhalla. Like, there's so much going on. It's unbelievable. Really something special.
I gotta ask you a crucial question.
Hit me.
Who run Barter Town?
Master Blaster!
Still?
Unfortunately, Barter Town is not in this film. We've okay. got...
No, I knew. I just wanted to...
We have the three main places people come from are the Citadel, which is the realm of Immortan Joe. It's where they control all the water and gasoline and car parts. There's Bullet Town, which is, as you might guess,
yeah,
the town where the bullets are at.
No explanation necessary.
And then Gas Town, which has a large bulk of the or guzzling.
Probably no explanation
exactly
on that one.
But there's something really
cool. That's where
cool.
you get the hot take on our reliance right. on fossil fuels.
Actually, it's way more subtle than that, wherein you don't really hear that much or see that much of Gastown. Gastown is really only talked about in two contexts. It's where Imperator Furiosa is originally supposed to be going in the opening chase when she turns away. And it's also where Immortan Joe calls one of his two allies. He calls the bullet leader from Bullet Town, who, as you may guess, fucking loves shooting people. Yeah. And then the people eater from Gastown, who's this big fat guy wearing a nice suit and he has a prosthetic nose made of like gold or copper. And then these big, like warped, warty, gout ridden feet. And so he can only ride around. He can't walk. And so you see these three men who represent the dogma of religion, war, and reliance on fossil fuels sort of teaming up to go to war against those who are just trying to find home and safety.
Now, I got to say, hearing you talk about this movie, I really want to see it. The trailer I wasn't necessarily sold on, but I like the idea of it. And hearing you and Brandon both gush over it in very different ways, because like Brandon like hit like basically just told us like there's a lot going on in this movie and then read us some tweets. You like tell us what's going on in the movie. It's very, you could tell you did real roulette with me, you know what I mean?
Oh yeah. But
here's where I would feel like a dick, because like I'm sitting here drinking Shiraz like, oh, how entertaining, like here talking about it, but I still have something in my head that we talked about last week, not on the show, that's been bothering me.
Hit me.
You legitimately like the first Mad Max movie?
Sure, yeah.
Why?
I more
it's
than
it's not even apocalyptic. That's what bothers me the most about it.
Like, I can see
it's
that,
not
absolutely.
Apocalyptic, and they don't explain the like Road Warrior is like where the world
yeah,
starts.
Totally.
And like it's just like a bunch of bikers chasing him. Like,
well, before I answer that, there's one other thing I want to say about Fury Road, which is in the way George Miller directs the action. This is a 72-year-old man, by the way, directing this. He does something brilliant, which is he slows the frame rate during the action scenes until you can understand what's going on. So basically, about 50 to 60% of the film is at 24 frames per second, which is the standard for theatrical cinema. And when he was watching the action scenes as they were editing, if he couldn't visually understand what was happening, he would slow the frame rate down until he could. So there's parts of this film that are running at like 12 frames a second or 14 frames a second or 18 frames a second. And you don't really notice it while you're watching it, except for the only way in which I noticed it was when I was watching. I was going, this is moving so fast, but I can see everything that's happening. Why can't Michael Bay do this?
Well, and I bet like you're more trained to see that kind of thing. Like I've noticed this about if you know extra things about movies, you will always subconsciously take that into you. And yeah. I'll give you an example, because I mean, I haven't ever run a projector or anything. But once I saw Fight Club and they talked about the cigarette burns, every time there's a cigarette burn on a movie, it fucking takes me out of the movie for just a second.
Yep.
Like I will never unsee that now. Now, fortunately, because stuff's going digital,
that
like,
doesn't happen anymore.
It rarely happens anymore. Occasionally happens when I see a movie, but not very often anymore, because they're just not there anymore. But
yeah, exactly.
I never noticed it before. And once I watch that movie, could not be unseen. And I'm betting maybe subconsciously you have some of this with like the frame rates.
Part of
too.
It. And yeah, I would agree. To most people, you wouldn't really notice that, except for when the only thing you'd notice is that you can really tell everything that's going on in the action scenes at all times. Like there's no point where the camera is so shaky or the action is so fast that you have no idea what's happening. Visually, the story is perfectly told.
And they say, like, I've heard a lot of subjection on like what makes Steven Spielberg such a great director, and there's a lot of things, but one of the things that they mention is that you can always tell what's going on in a frame, like even without dialogue. And I think that was a lot of what Soderbergh's experiment with Raiders was. Like he put it into black and white and then put in like a Nine Inch Nails album for the soundtrack. And it said, when you switch out the music and you switch it to black and white, you should still be able to recognize everything in the frame and understand what's happening without dialogue. And you totally can when you watch that. Like, even if you just remove yourself from what movie's about, you can tell what's going on.
And Mad Max Fury Road is sort of the logical extension of that. This movie is, if a lot of film students hear about the philosophy show, don't tell. Like, that's the big ethos. In a visual medium, show everything you can and only tell the things you cannot show. This film rides and dies with that. Like, it is completely show, don't tell, to the point that all of Tom Hardy's dialogue could probably fit on one piece of 8.5 by 11 paper, double spaced. It literally, like, everything, you are expected to be paying attention 100% of the time and connecting the dots that the visuals give you. And it's a complete success in that regard. I cannot wait to watch it again. I can't wait to watch it on Blu-ray. I can't wait for, George Miller said the Blu-ray will also include a black and white version of the movie. Can't wait for that. And I can't wait for the sequel. Can't come fast enough.
Okay, let's transition away from that. Defend the original Mad Max. Okay,
so what it really comes down to for me is a couple of things.
But people who may not be in the know, like, if you've seen Road Warrior, that is not the first Mad Max. It's literally called Mad Max.
Yeah.
Like, there's always confusion on that point, but it's basically like it's the Mad Max character played by Mel Gibson, you know, the first three. But he's like in a church or something, like, and a biker gang goes after him. I haven't seen it for a few years, but this biker gang goes after him, basically. Yeah,
he's a cop. He's in the main patrol force,
that's right,
or main force
in
patrol,
Australia, right? Like, yeah, around Australia. The outback or something.
Yep.
And that's the whole premise of the movie is just him fighting this biker gang.
Right. So here are the things that really like about it, and I'll admit it's not a perfect movie. In fact, there's a lot of arguments to be made that it's not a good movie.
That's the argument I'm making.
I find it a very enjoyable movie, and it's for a few reasons. One is it's super Australian, which is something that appeals specifically to me.
Okay.
I really like the visual look of the film, especially with the knowledge of how shoestring the budget was. I love the Mel Gibson performance in that movie. I think he just kills it. There's this way he sort of carries guilt and grief in his eyes and on his body that really works for me in that movie. I think the costume design is great. I think the performance of Hugh Keysburn as Toe Cutter is really good. And I think the Interceptor is one of the most badass cars in film history. And it's very slow moving. It doesn't, especially by today's standards, it's particularly slow moving. But there's something about the atmosphere when I watched that movie again that really sucked me in. And it really comes down to how good the Mel Gibson performance is and how inventive the direction is and the camera movements are, despite the fact that it's on a limited budget.
The weird thing about it is if these were all released nowadays, other than Fury Road, obviously, that would be the prequel where how did he get in the position to where he can handle it?
How did
apocalypse?
This guy become here? It's totally a prequel.
But it's insane that he's just like, all right, now it's the apocalypse for the next movie, which is a much better movie. Like, Road Warrior is amazing.
Yeah, Road Warrior is a phenomenal film.
Yeah, that's my favorite one. Thunderdome has moments.
Road Warrior is now my second favorite one because Fury Road exists.
Yeah, well, how do you feel about Beyond Thunderdome? I felt like it had its moments, and that's basically how I'd talk
I would agree in a very general sense. I'd agree with it has its moments. I think the first half is a lot stronger than the second half. The second half starts to become almost like a kid's film in the middle of an adult action movie.
Yeah.
But I do think it, when sort of taken as campy fun, it has a lot of entertainment value to be had. I mean, we have so much fun with the Master Blaster character.
Yeah, Tina that's a Turner. Moment.
Yeah, exactly.
Tina Turner is not great, she's not great in a, like,
campy, exciting way. Yeah. And so for me, that one's all about camp. And also, the other reason I enjoy that one is because it represents what was my favorite thing about the Mad Max franchise and is now completely my favorite thing about the Mad Max franchise with the existence of Fury Road, which is that each movie is completely different from the next. Like, they only are of a whole when you watch them closely together and understand that Mad Max is the through line through all of them. But in terms of plot and style, they're all completely different films. And that really adds to this idea of Mad Max as not so much a literal figure, but as a mythological figure. And I think if you look at Mad Max, the original film, or Beyond Thunderdome individually, they become much worse. But if you're like me and you enjoy certain aspects of them and you're willing to be an apologist from them, and then,
yeah,
okay,
when you add them into the greater context as the franchise as a whole, I think it's one of those situations where like a rising tide lifts all boats. Like the fact that Road Warrior and Fury Road are so good that it makes them better by association, because it adds things to those movies that aren't there in
Road
a vacuum.
Road Warrior has one of my all-time favorite endings. It's such a great ending. He like
with the feral kid?
Yeah, I guess spoiler if you haven't gotten around to watching this movie since, what, 1985 or whenever the fuck it was. So he handcuffs this guy to a motorcycle where these flames are about to like go into the gas tank. And of course, because it's a movie, it'll explode.
Uh-huh.
And he basically...
Well, don't they make a point of saying, though, that he rigged the gas tank to explode? Because I know he...
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
They do make a point of saying he rigs the...
Well, I wasn't saying it was an accident.
Interceptors, too.
But because he manufactures this whole situation, and Mad Max throws him a hacksaw and tells him, if you saw through your hand... You can get out in 12 seconds, but if you try and saw through the handcuffs, it'll take you like 45 seconds and it's going to explode in like 20 seconds. So, of course, the guy goes for the handcuffs as he's walking away and it fucking explodes and kills. It's great. I love that.
So
dude. It's
good.
Such a great ending to that movie. It's just such a cold move.
Uh-huh.
It's so great, though.
And it perfectly
the guy has
encapsulates what makes him the Road Warrior.
Yeah.
This sort of... almost like a Bedouin figure of the wasteland.
I'm sorry. You're getting so, like, you're waxing so intellectual
about
Mad Max. I love it.
So how far did I go? I think I promised 30 minutes on Mad Max.
You came fucking close, dude. It's like 27 minutes.
If I almost. Need to fill more, I've got
no,
way
that's
more
okay.
to say.
So let's do the natural transition. Mad Max, Mad Men.
Mad Men.
Because nothing says Mad Max like Mad Men.
So the very first thing I want to say about this season, the series finale, is... After all the think pieces throughout this season of, is this the last time we see Joan? Is this the last time we see Peggy? Is this the last time we see Pete? Totally wasn't. Everybody's in the finale.
Yeah. Is Roger in the finale? I think he has a very small part.
Very
right?
small yeah. role, but he's there.
Yeah, that's right. Because he banters with somebody.
Somebody.
I don't even remember now.
Yeah, somebody in the office.
Yeah. The secretary, because he has to fire
right.
the secretary.
That's right.
Because they're on to the fact that he can't like have enough work for two secretaries. Poor girl. Although she is really obnoxious.
Yeah.
Not I don't mean like I find her obnoxious. I just mean like her character was supposed to be obnoxious.
Yeah, exactly. Her role in that dynamic was to be obnoxious.
Okay, so I'm going to throw out some random thoughts here about this. So the first thing was like, it's occurred to me before, but it really was driven home when I was watching this, since we're talking about Roger. Roger was a character at the very beginning, like I liked this character, but I was like, this is like in real life would be one of the most least likable guys if you knew all these guys.
Uh-huh.
And he became the most likable guy
completely.
By the end of it. Like he might have been the only one, right? Like
mm-hmm.
everybody else got harder around the edges, except for maybe Don, but definitely not Don. But
no, Don's not super likable.
But well,
he's fairly likable.
I will say this, with the exception of one season when he's drunk all the time, specifically the one where he gets fired
right.
from, or basically bought out temporarily. I find Don always likable, just despicable for like his marriage, I guess.
Charming and endearing more than I find him likable.
I love Don.
Like, I feel like the way I sort of look at Don Draper within the context of all the show at this point is I look at him as someone who, like, I would vote for or follow into battle, but not someone I would want to spend a lot of time time with, like, as friends.
See, my thing with Don was, like, it's all the little things that add up for me. Like, for example, when Roger's having his daughter's wedding earlier in the series, and he has the blackface entertainers and stuff, and, like, Don is, like, the only one who finds this unacceptable.
Yeah.
You know, it's, like, or, like, the whole Nixon-Kennedy thing, and, like, Don is the only one who's a Kennedy man. Uh-huh. Like, it's these little touches that, like, endear me to Don. You know what I mean?
Totally, sure.
Like, he seemed like, and even, like, when he's at his worst, I understand why he's at his worst, and it's totally understandable. Whereas, like, somebody like Pete...
Oh, Pete.
Completely unexcusable. But I will give it to him, dude. He turned over a new leaf by the end of the series. That was surprising. Yeah. I never saw that coming.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I never saw that coming, that he would, like, regain his wife and, like, actually turn over another leaf and put his family first and realize that he wasn't, that he shouldn't be cheating and talk other people out of cheating and like that. Yeah. That, but it was earned too. It wasn't totally like it came earned. Out of nowhere. You could see where he was coming from. Absolutely. But it was still surprising. I totally. Really like that touch.
And I especially like that they leave it in such a way that you can either believe that Pete really did learn his lesson, or you can believe this is just another time he thinks he has it figured out and then falls apart again. Like, it fits you're right. both you could, narratives.
It could very well fit that narrative, but I like to believe he turned over.
Me too. I like leaf. To believe he figured it out. And it's one of those things where, like, it's about time he figured it out. Treating Trudy that way. Are you kidding me?
So I'm watching Don, and he's doing this Jack Kerouac thing, and I'm like, what are you doing, man? Like, he just, like,
hooking up with lonely diner waitresses.
One thing that's hard for me is, like, and we almost have to talk about the last couple of episodes because, like, the finale is so, like, intrinsic to the lead up to it, you know, which all episodes are, I think.
Totally.
Like, you can't watch a standalone that show. They're all linked to all the other ones, you know?
Absolutely.
But when, like, I've heard Matthew Weiner say he doesn't trade in symbolism. Like, if you see a scene in a show, there is never symbolism in the show, ever.
Yeah.
Like, that is not something he does. But it's like, I can see it, and I'm like, Jesus, really? Like when he's staring out the window at that meeting.
Yeah.
And he sees this building, and then he sees, like, an airplane flying over it. The thing I think right away... This is what pops in my head when I'm watching that. I think he wants
9/11 was an inside job.
No, I'm thinking, like, he wants to fly free. Like, that's literally what I'm thinking. And then he walks out of the meeting. But I'm like, no, but I heard Matthew Weiner said there's no symbolism. Like, and he's probably telling the truth. It's just, like, it's weird for some of these scenes. I think it's
one of those things where he's so damn talented that even though he doesn't mean to trade in symbolism, it happens anyways.
I kind of think
he's so good
at
it that he can't help himself.
Yeah, I kind of feel like that's the case.
Either that or it's... Actually, the other alternative is it's a lot like the Kolesnikov effect. Are you familiar with this?
No.
It's an idea in cinema, which is if you intercut a shot of an expressionless human face with other shots that are meant to bring up emotion, like, say, a dog getting hit by a car, and then maybe, like, I don't know, a plane hitting a building or whatever, and you intercut these images with an expressionless face, the audience will project emotions onto the expressionless face.
Betty, evil to the last drop, dude. Like, even when she's dying, she's using it. All right, maybe I read this differently, well, but when I watched it, me and my wife had a discussion about this, but when I watched this, like, I thought it was insanely unfair of her to, like, treat Don the way she did with, like, the kids and stuff and just be like, no, like, not only is her husband not going to watch, like, his own kid, but Don's not going to watch his kids. Like, yeah. That was intrinsically evil to me. And it was just her using her position to, like...
I wouldn't go so far as evil, but I would definitely say she is manipulative in the name of self-interest alone.
Yeah.
Everything I think Betty she wanted did to was in her own self-interest.
I think she wanted to punish them both at the end. Mm-hmm. Like, I really do. I think that's what that move is about.
It was about making herself feel better for the way they treated her. It was basically her last bit of vengeance.
And it's also like the way she treats her kids too. Like, no, I don't want you to grieve. Like, I don't want you to see. Like, that is an awful thing to do to somebody.
Yeah, to tell them how to feel about something traumatic in their life, especially poor Sally.
It's not just like tell them, because like I understand as a parent you have to guide and stuff,
right?
But to be like, to not give them a chance to say goodbye, to not like acknowledge what's happening, mm-hmm. like not give the kids a chance to have shroud some closure, it
away, keep that perfect.
Yeah, she's just like, she's as far as I'm concerned, dude, I didn't like her from the beginning. And I still don't like her. Like, she, and I had suspected something about this, and I argued vehemently with my wife. And then Matthew Weiner, from that same interview I was talking about with Symbolism, he was talking with Chris Hardwick a couple weeks ago on The Nerdist. And he actually, Chris Hardwick brought up this moment. I was so glad he brought it up because it vindicated myself in my argument with my wife, which was, you know, Don philandered on her all the time. But then when she finds out about his identity, it wasn't that he was lying to her about who he was. It was that he wasn't a blue-blooded like person. She couldn't deal with that. The rest of it was
she had spent her whole life working for this ideal of the perfect man, like from a good family with good money, with a good job.
And because once she found out that was a lie, come from that background,
her life was a lie by proxy in her eyes.
Yeah, it's just, she's so despicable. She really is.
She's a mean lady.
Like, the other females are great in it. Like, Peggy. Yeah. And it seemed odd to me that, like, they ended her in a love story. I'm not quite sure what to think about that. Yeah, that was
strange. And it's not even so much that I don't like the idea of ending her on a love story, but I would have maybe switched that scene somehow. You would have to do some writing gymnastics to make it work, but I would have switched that moment with her triumphant strut through the office in the penultimate episode. I would have maybe flopped those that she still gets that like romantic thing she was looking for throughout the series, but the moment you leave her on is sort of representative of who she became over the course of the series.
Do you think what they were trying to say with that moment was that like Peggy was so focused on career that her love life was like straining, and then she has this like opportunity to be her own boss and she turns it down for love? Like, I mean, so is that saying she can have it all now? Like, she can have a love life and
I think it's saying she can have it all in a more specific way, in so much as it's saying that for the first time she understands what she truly wants. For a while she thought what she wanted was true love. Then what she thought she wanted was complete career upward mobility and satisfaction in the working life.
See, I felt like she always wanted upward mobility.
She totally did. Yeah. But I think what she's realized is that she doesn't have to sacrifice one for the other. She can sacrifice a little bit of both to achieve happiness in both. And I think that's what that's supposed to mean.
Okay,
that's what I took it.
That makes sense. I gotta be honest though, I would have been like, love scene or not, or love drama or not, I would have been happier with her taking that job with Peggy.
Me too.
I think that would have been so great. Like, her like actually like getting to the top and not having to deal with this bullshit with men. But maybe that's not who Peggy is. Like, maybe she's constantly gonna be in the trenches and that's part of who she is.
Yeah, like, she has that grinder in her. Like, it's not enough to be at the top of the mountain. She has to have something to work through.
Yeah, yeah.
She needs something to overcome.
It's like the old Greek tale where like the guy has Sisyphus. Like, you know, old syphilis. Pushing that rock up the hill. But like, an interesting thing about the tale of Sisyphus that I guess most Americans have missed out on. I didn't get this until I heard somebody talk about it, and then I reread the tale and I was like, oh, that's true. So like, people enjoy pushing that rock up the mountain. It's not supposed to be a torture, which is what we've like twisted it into in modern day America. It's actually like, the rock rolls down, but he enjoys the journey back up the mountain every single day. Like, and it's a parable for how to live your life, you know?
And I also think with Peggy, she is one of those people that So a lot of people are motivated by their goals, with the goals sort of representing the destination of their journey, right? But Peggy never was that. It was never about an endgame for her. What motivated her was overcoming things. And if you take away obstacles from Peggy, she has nothing left to fight for. Like, she runs out of road.
Yeah. She is the Sisyphus of the show, for
sure. Totally.
Not
the
syphilis.
So then who's the Tantalus?
Which one's Tantalus?
Tantalus was the one. His punishment in hell was to be perpetually thirsty and in a lake, and the water would rise up to his neck and slowly submerge him and drown him in water. But as soon as he tried to take a drink, the water level would drop back down. That was Tantalus.
I mean, if it wasn't for the end, it would be Pete, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Keeps doing better, but it's never enough. It's never enough, and he never enjoys it, and he goes bald. And I read some interesting things. They said, like, if you watch the pilot of Mad Men, which I'm going to do here pretty soon,
it
predicts so much, like, of the series. Like, even, like, and so what got me thinking about that was, like, Don tells Pete that he's going to wind up being, like,
yeah, no one's
if he
gonna
keeps
like you.
Chasing the secretary, nobody will like you. And you'll be fat and bald and all this.
And
like,
totally
that's exactly
is.
What
nobody likes
to him.
He's fat and he's bald.
And it's funny, best. Nobody put that context together until the series ended. You know?
But credit to Vincent Kartheiser. He kept his face as punchable as always.
Now we got to talk about Don.
Yeah.
Okay. What did you think about this whole story with him?
I think.
He clearly doesn't learn anything for chasing the women, I think.
No, he has not learned anything.
I think
anything
that's
from
a
that.
Scar that'll be with him forever. Like, it's basically because he was raped when he was a kid.
Yeah, that's
like he
a
was
whole
raped by a prostitute.
Though.
He didn't want to have sex with her. He wasn't ready. And so he's always going to be drawn to these chaotic women of a certain type.
Yeah, you know? he has a wheelhouse, that's for sure.
Yeah. Everybody but Betty fits that. But Betty's chaotic, but she's not like dark-haired.
That's but maybe she was up. At one time.
It's possible.
Maybe in like 1957.
It's
she
entirely
had bitch
possible.
And dark hair.
Yeah.
I almost feel like I need to rewatch the whole show to really understand Don's arc. Because I mean, considering he is the protagonist, there's so much going on with that character.
Yeah.
And by the end of it, there's so much tangled together and there's so many things about him that are both contradictory and completely supportive of other things we know about him, to the point where I almost feel like I need to take a solid day just to untangle Don.
So here's
which
what
might be the point of the show.
Here's what I feel
he's
about
a Gordian knot.
About like the last couple of episodes was like, so I think like, He likes to wander into towns and be the stranger and like helpful.
He's got
somehow.
That Clint Eastwood man with no name thing going on.
Yeah, he really likes that. He enjoys that. He always has in the series. Like he likes to go on road trips and not let people know who he is and
absolutely
like play the stranger, which I mean is really how he lives his life anyway. He's not using his real name.
Yeah,
because we're referring to it as Don, but his real name is Dick
Whitman.
Dick Whitman. And I think when he's like, so he's talking at one point in one of the earlier episodes and realizes like he has nothing left to do. Like he's a dinosaur at this point. Like he's just at the top of the food chain. He's got nothing to strive for at this point.
Nothing left.
And then
prove.
He gets what was left to, you know, to prove, which was like Coca-Cola. That was like the dream job from
and
the very beginning of the show.
And not just getting Coca-Cola, but creating something iconic with Coca-Cola.
Well, and he does that at the end, yeah. But I mean, like before that, he gets Coca-Cola and it's just like, he doesn't even want it anymore.
Yeah.
Like he doesn't know what the hell he wants. And
he
so
doesn't remember why he wanted it in the first place.
And, he's just doing all this stuff. And then I really think he had a moment where he's talking on the phone with Betty and like he realizes he wants to be with his kids and like help them through this whole thing. And she fucking chaoses him out of it, you know,
as she does.
Yeah. And he's just like broken at that point. So then he goes this yoga thing. And so I think at the end, he was searching for love throughout the entire series, which
I
makes sense.
I think it's very much love these, and peace are the two things he's looking
for. Yeah. He goes after these like, these crazy women who can never love him.
Or at the very least, not love him in the way he wants or needs to be loved.
Yeah.
And it's, he's always strained with this family, no matter who it is, you know, mm-hmm. it's a strained relationship, but like he finally goes to this and he loves being the stranger. And then he finds a stranger and finally like embraces him. And that's like where he finds his love, like in the arm of a stranger. And it's not even like a sexual thing. It's yeah. just like he finally finds a release.
He finds his home in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Like he is among his people.
And so from that enlightened state, he does like what I do consider to be one of the best commercials of all time. That Coke commercial, they still rerun all the time.
All the time.
Where they like and hold hands. And
even
sing
if it's
in different
not
languages.
The best, it's absolutely one of the most iconic.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I mean, they still. Like what, 50 years later or
it's
however
still getting
long it's
play.
Been. Yeah, it's still.
And they're still calling back to it. And it really is at this point the brand identity for Coke.
Yeah.
This idea. I mean, you're seeing it with what Coke is doing in their marketing now with these labels that have share a Coke with and then a random person's name, right? Like it all goes back to that same idea of strangers holding hands and becoming one and finding unity. And it's everlasting for that company. It's yep. something they tapped into a vein of humanity that advertising, which has basically run our blood dry with track marks. He found this one pulsing vein that hadn't been exploited and found its full potential almost immediately.
But it was coming from a good place, too.
Yeah, from a relatively healthy place.
Yeah, I've been having this argument with my wife lately because she hates Don, dude. Just hates
I don't blame
him because
her.
He cheats
All
on,
women
on his
should
wife.
Hate Don.
Right.
If but, you're a lady, you should
okay,
hate Don.
But here was my point. I like fired back at her because it suddenly occurred to me. I got my sense of enlightenment while we're watching the last episode. I'm like, you know what? Why do you hate Don so much? I'm like, pull out any other character in this movie and tell or in this show mm-hmm. and tell me why they're a better person than Don. Like everybody else is despicable in their own ways in the show and lovable in their own ways. Mm-hmm. And like Don is the same, but to me, a little more lovable.
And that's what I really think is one of the most masterful strokes about this show is depending on who you are as an individual and what your perspective is as an individual. Like you can see the light and dark of all of these characters to varying degrees. And it really is about what connects with you, what you relate to, what you like about people to the point where like you can love Don and your wife can hate Don. And like you can,
but it's still not okay.
And you can hate Betty.
I have
some
to be
people,
right in all arguments.
Some
with
people
my
can
wife.
See the beauty and love in Betty, you know, like all these characters have so many different sides and shadings to them. And they all have these different acts that define them throughout the show that makes them more human than most characters in most TV shows, where at a certain point, even when there's shades of gray in other TV shows, you're pretty much along somewhere on a binary pole. Whereas this show is more like a grid and there's a whole bunch of different places and zones you can be on that grid. And all of those can mean things independent of one another.
Okay. So transitioning away from that, So I was listening to This American Life today and it was an older episode, but they were talking about, I'm not going to get into exactly what they're talking about, but they talk about the metaphor of sex as baseball.
Sure, sure.
Shannon, this is your last chance. Tune out right now. Anyway, so,
but before you tune out, ask your dad what third base is.
Well, that's the thing. They said this is a horrible metaphor because it's like these four things and like you can't go backwards or forward. There's no like, there's nothing in between. And so I started thinking about that and the NBA playoffs is going on. And I immediately realized they're right. Baseball is a terrible metaphor for sex. We need to go to basketball, dude.
Okay.
And so I started breaking this down and maybe you can help me with this a little
okay.
bit. So like points, uh-huh. like the points you score is basically like how many women you score with, right?
If okay, you're sure.
Because we're going to look at this through the eyes of a man, right?
Not just a man, a bro.
Yeah, bro. Okay. So points is like the point or, you know, how many women you score with.
Okay.
Okay. Rebound. Obviously, that's like you're hurt by a woman.
Yeah, you
so you
get
nail
dumped,
another woman.
Yeah. Obviously.
That's a rebound. Uh-huh. Okay. Assist.
Uh-huh.
That's third base in baseball.
Oh, see, I thought you might be going an assist is when you help get a buddy get laid. I thought that's what an
no,
assist
no, no.
would
we'll
be.
Get to that.
Okay.
We'll get to that. That's in positions. Because that's your wingman. He plays wing, right?
Sure.
He's playing wing. Right. The center is when you're just like, you're in it no matter what. The world can be on fire around you. You're like, you're centered on like getting this girl at the bar. Like, you're gonna,
the point guard make it is happen. The bartender then, right?
It's a playmaker, dude. That's the guy who's just like hitting on like every girl in the entire bar. Oh, he's the playmaker. I figured
that'd be the shooting guard, the guy who's gonna take a shot, whether it's a complete guaranteed 2 points every time, or whether it's a complete shot in the dark 3-pointer from the half court line.
Oh no, that's the off guard. Okay. Yeah, no, definitely, because he's a little bit off in his approach. But like the playmaker is like making a play for every girl in the bar, because he's the dude who has that approach. Like if I hit 100 women, at least one of them's gonna say yes. Right, he's in it to win it at the end. Whatever he's got to do, if he's got to use the wing, he'll use the wing. It doesn't matter. Like whatever gets him to the hole.
Okay, right? I'm with you. Very apt metaphor, by the way.
That's right. Okay, so I was also thinking like a steal is when like obviously that's like when a guy's got a girl and you're just like, no, that's my girl now. You just pulled off a steal, like. You know,
show up with a,
he's out of town for a week or something.
Oh, see, I figured it was like that move in the bar where one guy's talking to the girl and you show up with a Bahama Mama and sort of nudge him out of the way.
I would say that would also qualify for a steal. There's a couple ways to steal. You can swipe at him. You can
you can full on dive for the loose ball.
A block shot is basically when you cock block your friend, dude.
Okay.
Like that's a block shot, right?
Deal.
So I probably thought this out way more than
I
should have.
Could a block shot also be when the girl's friends gets involved?
Oh, yeah.
And like lead her away, that move?
Oh, yeah, because they're the defense, dude. They're trying to stop you from getting to the hole, right? That's why they show up in a group and they have everybody assigned to like watch... Like
very well coordinated. I'll give them credit for
that's right. They're running a zone to keep you away from the hole.
So what's goaltending?
Goaltending. I didn't think that. I didn't quite get that far yet.
What's a flagrant foul?
Well, a flagrant foul is like, I mean,
that's when you spill your beer on her, right? That's a flagrant foul.
Well, we have to go dark if we're going to talk flagrant. It's like, what are we talking? Flagrant how one, dark? Flagrant two, or flagrant three?
I'm really scared to find out what will happen if I say flagrant three. So
flagrant three is a rape.
Yeah, it's kind of what I figured you'd say.
Yeah, yeah. Flagrant three is a rape.
I don't want to talk about flagrant.
Flagrant
three.
Two is
I don't
like,
know that I want to hear about flagrant two.
Flagrant two is like she's probably had too much to drink. No. It's on the line. You don't
so
know.
So rape then.
I get, well, she might be okay. It's hard to say. Like, she's your girlfriend and she's had too much to drink and you have some history, but not enough. Okay. That's like a flagrant two.
Okay. Sure.
And a flagrant foul is just like when you get too drunk and you make too hard of a pass on somebody and they just walk away from you. That's a flagrant one.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And a technical foul is like you said, like spilling a drink or something, just completely fucking up your game.
All right, I'm with
without
you.
Without doing anything like intentionally horrible.
You're just too dumb to get your own feet moving in the right direction. You can't tell which end you shit out of.
And I'm not making light of rape, but that's flagrant three is the worst call in basketball.
That's
dude.
Right.
Rape is the worst.
To get a flagrant three in an NBA game, you basically have to shoot somebody.
Yeah, Gilbert Arenas, that shit.
Yep, pick one.
So that was a weird place I had to go to for a minute.
That was
so.
A fun little excursion.
Yeah, dude, I thought about this way too much today, man. Evidently. Like I'm like at work trying to do my job, and I can't help but think about this all day long. I don't know what's wrong with me.
I mean, so much, but we don't have the time.
You had something you wanted to sting on the end here?
Well, first I need to apologize to Josh Trank.
Oh, that's right.
So, many of you listeners may remember us going in depth on Josh Trank and the rumors surrounding him on the sets
of
Fantastic
Four. Did say it
was a
rumor, did say if it was true multiple times.
So, you might remember me saying that the talk of the town was that Simon Kinberg directed the reshoots for the film, correct, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yesterday, another rumor leaked saying that Simon Kinberg did not direct the reshoots on the film. Fox brought in Matthew Vaughn to direct the reshoots on the film.
Oh, is which that, is I mean, they're really trying to connect it to X-Men, maybe?
Well, no, because he didn't do Apocalypse. Singer's completely in charge of X-Men at this point. Or Days of Future Past. Singer's completely in charge of
X-Men. But he's still linked to the X-Men.
Well, no, he's a Fox studio director. Okay. Matthew Vaughn is. Everything didn't he's made with the exception. He did.
Okay.
But he See, also did Kick-Ass for Fox. He also did Kingsman for Fox. He also did Stardust for
Okay,
Fox.
But my point is, if you're like they've made it known that they want to connect these two
right.
these two franchises.
Right, but it has more to do with him being a guy that has a contract with the studio that they could call and basically obligate to do
okay,
the work.
Okay, but I'm saying like possibly.
In any case, it doesn't matter. It's all a moot point because somebody asked Josh Trank about those rumors and he said very curtly and very definitively, he did not address the rumors of his behavior on set in any way, shape, or form. But the thing he did say was, there is only one director on Fantastic Four and that's me. So to Josh Trank, I'm sorry I said Simon Kinberg directed part of your movie. Although I'm not so sure it would have been the worst decision.
I'm not sure that that's necessarily like... Yeah, I don't feel like I owe Josh Trank any kind of apology.
Well, the shit you were saying, he didn't deny at all, which is why I didn't say yeah. we owe him an apology, right. just me, because I accused him of not directing
his own movie.
I'm
not entirely sure that's not the case either.
Me either, but
that
until...
That could be... That, I mean, if there's any salt to these rumors...
Until someone else on that set says otherwise, I'm sort of forced to believe that that's the case with him.
Yeah, okay.
You're Although I'm fair. Still willing to believe that he showed up high on coke, which maybe I shouldn't be, like maybe that's super fucked up, but I'm not saying it's true. I'm just saying I'm willing to believe it.
I'm saying it's probably true. What do I care? What do I know? I'm drinking fucking Shiraz, talking about Mad Men, linking that to like Mad Max and freaking basketball as a sex metaphor. What do I give a shit, Josh Trank? You're gonna come look me up in Helena?
He's never gonna find us.
I'm not worried about it. I do want to throw out a quick plug for the Alien Movie Project because we were talking about
AMP.
That's right. We were talking about the feminist aspect of Mad Max, and they do an excellent job exploring that in the last two episodes where they do Alien and Aliens, yeah. which we talked about a little bit on this show with Aaron Donaldson. And he had what I really liked was the stuff we talked about on Skies because I re-listened to it a little while ago. Not really what they cover at all when they talk about Alien and Aliens. Like,
really?
Yeah. Like, nice. I mean, like similar subject matter, but definitely like way different
taking
specifics.
A different angle.
Yeah. Taking a very different angle. Like that show was so good, dude. Like, honestly, like that one and We Had a Good Life, I just like look forward to listening every single week. I can't wait.
When we have the Not Safe for Network extravaganza, I want to record a mini Alien Movie Project with them where we can talk about Mac and Me. That's yeah. my next big goal in
I
life.
I think we're going to have to get on Facebook and really like start figuring out specifics about yeah, it. Because we talked right. about doing a,
we're
a
less
chaotic
than a month
like...
Out.
Yeah, we talked about doing a chaotic thing, but it almost seems like maybe they want to do shows. I don't know. We'll discuss
pitch options.
This out.
We'll come up with some options. We'll pitch it. We'll see what everybody has to say. This is a democracy.
Yeah.
So I do have my one little tag.
Okay.
A film was released this Friday called Tomorrowland, directed by Brad Bird, starring George Clooney. It's a whole thing. I have not seen it yet, but I did read an interview with Damon Lindelof, who wrote the script for the film, and he talked about his pitch for a post-credit scene for the movie that was rejected. And his pitch for the post-credit scene...
Wait, before you get into it, what's Tomorrowland supposed to be about?
They don't give you a ton of exposition in the trailers, but basically it's about this young girl who finds a pin that when she touches it allows her to access this super futuristic dimension.
Okay.
And eventually she gets lost. She meets up with George Clooney, who's from that area, and it becomes an adventure as he takes her into Tomorrowland.
Okay. All right.
But the post-credit scene Damon Lindelof pitched might be one of the five best unfilmed scenes in cinema history. So it was
doesn't
gonna,
involve Stanley.
No, better.
Okay.
So he sort of set the scene in this interview and he said, the camera would have been very still and focused right in the center of the frame on the Tomorrowland pin that's featured in the trailer. and a hand would reach down to pick up the pin from the floor. And as the hand picked it up, the camera would zoom out to reveal Samuel L. Jackson wearing an eye patch, holding a purple lightsaber, and dressed in the Frozone costume from The Incredibles. And then he would look right down the barrel of the camera and say, "Aw, hell, I'm in this one too." And end of movie.
That's great. And I gotta say, you know what's really crazy? When you said better than Stanley, I was about to say better than one of the highest grossing actors of all time, and immediately my head went to Samuel L. Jackson. Uh-huh. And I'm so glad I kept my mouth shut, because I would have totally ruined that totally. If I said that.
So
that's amazing, because that is better than Stanley.
So much better, especially with the with lightsaber and the eye patch and the Frozone costume. Amazing. Just amazing. Shout out to you, Sam Jackson. May you never die. Long live the king.
We don't want him to die.
No,
that's
no,
what that
no.
was all about.
Never, never.
All right. Take it easy.
Network. And we respect the outro.
So being in harmony is respecting the outro?
Mm-hmm. I mean, relatively, compared to what we normally do.
Sweet. Let's do another half hour.
Great. I've got so many thoughts on Mad Max Fury Road and potential sequel ideas.
Not safe for network.
So when you get the actual script in your hands, how is it that you memorize everything?
I mean, there's like, you write the first letter of each word.
That's what Robert Downey Jr. does.
Sure, yeah. And that's great for Robert Downey Jr., but
that's
just
great for Robert Downey Jr.
That just gets me so confused.
RDJ.
So
RDJ.
We won't be seeing you in an Iron Man suit anytime soon.
Well, not on stage. In my off time, maybe. But I don't know what you're doing in my bedroom, so please leave.
That's debatable.
I think the way we argue matters. The more diverse populations we have to argue with, the better. The internet, it gives you a lot of zealotry, and a lot of that is saying, you know, 9/11 was an inside job, or the moon landing never happened, or whatever. But, you know, if we could look at the flip side of that, too, you get a whole bunch of information that gets to fly around the world in a heartbeat, and all of a sudden everybody knows the same damn thing.
We had a good life.
Is talking about the Juggalo community mm-hmm. on the podcast, so publicly as we do,
yeah.
does that set us up as a target in the future, potentially?
It's as much of a threat as a dirty 400-pound topless woman like running at you from a couple hundred yards away can be. You know what I mean?
This is family over
it's
here.
Family.
Box office battle.
If you were to take the male lead of your film and put him into a romantic comedy, would I root for him?
I have to say, we have seen this romantic comedy. Liv Tyler is his daughter, and he saves the human race in Armageddon.
Is that a romantic comedy, though?
You know, you had me until you said Armageddon.
Shooting the show.
My parents always stocked up on ramen. They didn't really know how much I ate. And I would actually scrounge up change and go to the store and buy more ramen so it didn't look like I ate as much.
Eric.
That's what alcoholics do. My mom should have never taught me how to make it.
Yeah, you had a problem.
The Alien Movie Project.
The aliens crash a kid's birthday party, basically.
Which, again... I think supports the frat aliens notion. Oh god, where am I? Oh guys, hey, is there anything to drink at this party? You guys,
I'm gonna have some of this cake.
Hey,
you guys mind if I cut this cake?
Can I open this? Are you gonna wear that hat?
I'm just gonna take some of this cake.
Montucky Skies.
By the way, his character trait is he constantly pulls out stomach acid pills. What do you call it? Like Pepto-Bismol or something? And he just constantly chews the pills every time something comes around. He's like, argh.
Yeah.
Just chewing the paint.
Can I just say,
washes them down with a cup of coffee.
I appreciate the subtlety used by saying his character trait, because we know this is the type of movie where each character gets one trait.
Find all our podcasts on iTunes. Not safe for network.